I should start and get my excuses out of the way. I'm going to read this because retirement does not enhance one's memory. And also, I don't have any aids on the blackboard or whiteboard because I'm going to talk about perceptions and they're not really hard-nosed enough to make bullet points. But it's not often duty and pleasure coincide. The pleasure is being here, where I spent over 30 happy years. The duty is that it should be for a contemporary historian to bring what he can to current debates, especially one as controversial as the European Union. Yet, however much I try to defend contemporary history, one has to ask the question, how can it illuminate the present and the future, especially when the prevailing political myth is that the past is not relevant at all except as a source of recrimination? I'm not going to try and retell the EU's history. It took 600 pages when I tried to do part of it 12 years ago. There is a problem, in any case, of describing the whole rather than the component parts. One can talk about competition law, labor law, foreign relations, immigration. But my question today is about perceptions of what the EU actually is, and the old dichotomy, which we all know, between the formal, which we can all read if we ever get round to it, and the real. One could ask, separately, how the EU is perceived by its component parts, by member states, by their governments, by their institutions, their publics, and their media. You've got a whole range of variables. And what this mass of different perceptions actually says about its nature, as well as its purpose. It'll help, I think, if I fix on some historical events or processes, because most things in the EU are continuing. Starting in the 1950s with the original six and the successive accessions until we end up with today's 27 member states. First, inevitably, a few qualifications. One has to take account of the phenomenon that what is said by the EU collectively will be subtly different from what its component parts say and from what member states say to their own country and what the EU Parliament debates. And then one has to ask, what do the journalists, television reporters, and hence the 27 national publics actually hear? This dichotomy contributes to the sense of double vision, and I think rests on what I have to describe as a toxic combination of media distortion and domestic political competitive argument. Contemporary history has two uncomfortably close neighbors, journalism and political science, yet it can and should benefit from and assist both. Anchoring today's power struggles not only to their origins, but to the sense of a continuing present, which is why the French call it rather better, I think, l'histoire du temps présent. My underlying question then becomes, is the EU the embodiment of a sort of original intelligent design from which it can only marginally vary, or is it the irregular product of a chaos of competing interests shifting continuously in the half century since the Treaty of Rome? Well, you would hardly expect me to pick either the idealist or the cynical realist standpoint, but to set the mark somewhere between, while avoiding mere relativism or speculation. To do so, we then have to come to terms, and Ian very kindly referred to my interviewing to get into contemporary history. We have to come to terms with the facts of multiple overlapping and contradictory perceptions. And that's what I mean by double vision. You're all familiar with the well-known example in which the police stage an accident in front of a small crowd outside a pub. And then when it's happened, they collect 15 people, interview them, and there are 15 quite different accounts. That's, I think, a fairly well-known experiment. Most of us, after all, are still unclear about the final interpretations, say, of the Spanish Civil War. And it's not only member states as nation states. The view from the UK includes what Margaret Thatcher used to call they, meaning the Scots and the Welsh, of course, and the Northern Irish, where the views of the EU are often very different from the English view. After all, what but European money transformed the roads of Scotland and Wales, if you ever drive there, or the higher education of Cornwall? Only perhaps during the 1975 referendum were these different perceptions within the United Kingdom congruent. At least that's my opinion. In the medical sense, double vision can be corrected. As a political disorder, it can be irremediable, if not remarkably hard to alleviate, because it's based on a combination of relative ignorance and media mythology. Sorry if I'm using stereotypes. Yet I do remember, and I believe this, in 1975, it was ameliorated by widespread public discussion. I myself took part in this, on the side of the Europeans, I have to admit. And I once organized a debate attended by over 400 people in Shoreham Town Hall, addressed by an oddly effective combination of the late Quintin Hogg and the then Bishop of Chichester. The church, not militant, but European. Don't imagine that the problem of overlapping perceptions disappears higher up the scale, among the interest groups, the committees, or even member state governments, who argue out what EU policy will become. At that level, I think, perceptions are only better defined, more intensely argued, differently combative. And, of course, crucially, as public ones are not, they are open to resolution by compromise that allows for the self-interested bargaining by political parties, by whole industrial sectors, banks and financial institutions. Ian didn't mention that, but it's crucially important now. And what remains of labor movements. And success is often based on access to what is believed to be the center, that is the Commission and the European institutions, and of course the matrix of the Council of Ministers itself. What I'm suggesting is that the EU does not easily provide a mean or final answer on any of the great policy issues. Yet that, according to the Treaty of Rome, is what the Commission should initiate while the Council of Ministers disposes once the Parliament has had its day. Of course, that's formally true, but in a sense, it's also the simple version. The more complex one looks at the vast range of preliminary meetings with industries or unions or banks, especially with experts. The EU has a habit, a good habit, of sucking in experts, whatever the subject may be. It could be the chemical industry, it could be banking regulation, and extracting from what is useful to the general aim of the legislation they're planning. Don't forget the regions also. Then you have the Commission's long gestation process to produce something on which the permanent representatives can negotiate to produce the agenda for the Council of Ministers. And finally, of course, the Council of Ministers will haggle endlessly over it. Also, another point, in the end, much of what occurs is reactive. The EU is not necessarily an originating body. It reacts to the various players' own perceptions about external events, about global economic pressures, as well as their internal needs. If I took a simple example, which I happen to have been involved in, wearing a different hat, the directive on banks' capital adequacy, how much a bank has to have to deal with, say, Northern Rock. Basel, which is a meeting place for central bankers, produced its second report, and the EU believed that it had to have a directive to keep pace with that. It had to take account not only of each member state, the banks who gave evidence to it, But what those outside the European Union were thinking and likely to do, particularly the largest American banks and the view of the American Treasury. All this necessarily, I think, I use the word necessarily and I mean it, makes the process an elite project. One thing more before I come to the test cases, a definition. Much, I think, of the public antagonism, and there's plenty of it in this country, centers on the word federal. But is the European Union federal? English doesn't really have a satisfactory word for federal, or for other, I don't mean that, sorry, a satisfactory word for what the European Union is. The Germans call it Staatenverbund, an association of nation states, each seeking their own interest within a greater common good. Personally, I think confederal is a better word to use. But we really have only the Swiss model in Europe, with its cantons of different size, populations, languages, and cultures. And it is to appease the British that so many of our partners in the European Union have avoided the word federal whenever they can. If you put this question in public, if you watch television, or discuss it with people who are not directly involved, I think the answer you will get is usually federal, with the connotation that it means surrendering sovereignty. We've all probably come across that. Whatever that may mean to a country, which surrendered most of its defense strategy to NATO in 1949 and to the American supply of Trident since, and I'm not going to mention the Iraq War. But, and I put it in quotes, Brussels' rule may be no more than a taunt based on the assumption that the EU is a federal structure with an overarching central power, as it is in the United States or perhaps Spain. Yet neither federal nor confederal really provides a model, because nation states are not like Texas, Bavaria, or Baden-Württemberg. And hence, when I wrote the book, back in 1995, I used the phrase a new sort of state possessing some of the attributes of a national state, a body of law and practice, but not a universal code, courts to interpret this, a central bank, a common currency, but not for all member states, a policy defining civil service, and a framework for decision making. All those are attributes of the modern state. And I have to say, it is possible that since then there has been a movement in a federal direction with member states' acquiescence simply in order to get things done via majority voting. And I'll try and come back to that. It seems certain that amongst those most closely and habitually involved in the Commission, the Central Bank, and a body called CORREPER, which negotiates the Council of Ministers' agenda, there exists a belief that they, and we're talking of a relatively small number of people, are operating in a context and an ethos similar to a state, but of a very peculiar kind. Yet even these people speak differently. On the one hand, the Commission officials who will go out, they're very open Commission officials, they will go out to get expertise, they will talk to almost anybody I found. But they also employ a close and specialized language, rather like central bankers, rather like judges in their own sphere. And then when they come to talk to ministers, they talk a slightly different language, perhaps over-defined, perhaps a little simplified. Ministers themselves, of course, employ two or maybe three languages, one with their Brussels committee colleagues, one to their media, one to their own parliaments and electorate. And that's not to say that they're all two-faced, only that, like the Roman god Janus, they have to face two or three different publics at the same time. So to my first case, the Treaty of Rome. In 1957, setting up the EEC emerged from a very complex post-war history over the bodies of many other failed essays in Reconstruction, such as the European Defence Committee, the Monnet-Schumann Plan, the Franco-Italian Customs Union. There are many of those that never came to fruition. It didn't solve the problem of recovery. Actual economic recovery had been underway in Europe for several years. And there was the model of the coal and steel community, a working model for the process of integration. Now, since the 1970s, historians have employed three main forms of explanation about the driving force behind the Treaty of Rome. First, the Federalist one, which cites high politics. Then there's the one which defines the United States' European recovery program as a hegemonic project. And then there's what I see as the realist one, the sustained interplay of six national interests, because as we all know, Britain excluded itself from the key Messina conference. Six national interests in their combined self-interest and aggrandizement. Argument about how those national perceptions of interest were derived continues, even by implication, even today. What else, in European terms, is Sarkozy's rupture imply? Part of the process necessarily required cutting down those separate multiple demands, which in turn forced the competitors to decide what they really wanted and what really mattered. And that shaped the outcome. You have a process of narrowing options down and explains why so many deep but controversial principles, such as progress to monetary union and majority voting, were stored up for the future in the treaty's introduction. Even then, one can discern groupings, federalists, nationalists, free marketeers. But I think only if that is the standpoint you work from, which confirms what you find. An overall standpoint would have to take account of much wider forces, the Cold War and the Russian threat, relations with Eastern Europe, particularly as regards West Germany, and for Britain, the vestiges of empire and its post-imperial trade. It's a curious fact that the fiasco of Suez in 1956 actually forced France to act more quickly to get the EEC established. So the Treaty of Rome was, in short, specific to its time, yet pregnant with long-term collective aspirations. And I don't think anybody, no one in this room, I suspect, would argue with that. It's a truism. Yet even then, there were divergent perceptions about what each one gained. You look at the Netherlands and, to a lesser extent, Belgium. They saw a passage to economic growth and efficiency in the removal of the grosser barriers to trade and in some diminution of state aid to industry, while West Germany found in it an avenue to peaceful, primarily economic expansion, free from post-war blame and guilt. Italians of the Salotto Buono, the political elite, welcomed an external force whose regulatory power might reform its corrupt, inchoate state and Christian democratic inertia. France saw and took the chance to embody in the treaty and its implementation the logic and administrative skills of its énarque, for whom the EEC and French interests would usually coincide, at the same time as coming to terms with what post-war Germany might become. Extensions of membership occurred at irregular intervals and for very different reasons, depending on the perception of advantage held by each of the original six and the strategies of the various applicants in presenting themselves. One could say that in 1971-73, British entry was achieved only because of Edward Heath's profound conviction about the nature of the modern state, coincided roughly and for a short time only with that of the French, and because Pompidou was not de Gaulle. In contrast, the entry of Ireland with its predominantly agricultural economy was not problematic, and Denmark had long been acceptable to everybody. Without being derogatory, a little later, Greece's entry was a prize for good conduct in ousting an unpleasant military dictatorship and an insurance against backsliding. It was too small a case to impede the EEC's 1970s progress, however much many member states wished subsequently that it hadn't happened. Yet, against French obduracy, the same arguments did not apply to Spain and Portugal. For 7 years, in my opinion, an utterly partisan and unjustifiable stance, largely on behalf of southern French farmers. And it's worth saying that Spain's remarkable post-Franco transformation may even have been sharpened by this, so that when entry did come, Spain became a successful, sometimes very demanding player almost at once. Later still, Austria and Sweden's entry presented few challenges, almost universal acceptance. But Eastern Europe, after the Soviet Union collapsed, presented a very diverse, continuing dilemma which seemed to some, especially to French observers, to undermine what the EU had become in the 1980s. There's no need to point out their social and economic divergences. Czechoslovakia was not Romania, the Baltics were not a unity. Slovenia was a much better applicant than had been envisaged. Central and Eastern European entry opened up not only fundamental questions of what the EU was and what entries should be and what entry tests should be applied, but of how far it could theoretically extend. Ukraine, perhaps, Moldova, probably not, Belarus, certainly not, and Turkey, well, that's for the next 10 years. There is, of course, no set boundary, justifiable in geography, economy, or history. Only perhaps in the spread today of a mass culture and possibly a West European definition of political democracy. And it's not much use recalling a remote past when Christianity faced Islam or the Teutonic Knights faced Russian Orthodoxy. Yet the prejudices from so remote a past still exist, and within Central European member states, the 1919 Treaty of Trianon is still a live issue between Hungary and Romania. My third test has to be the single market and its indissoluble link to the Maastricht treaties, a linkage which proved to be the Rubicon for many British observers. And that too, the whole project is inseparable from the vast change of context created by the end of the Cold War, by German reunification, and by the failure of Gorbachev's project in the Middle Way. There are two widespread misapprehensions prevalent in what one might call recent British political historiography, both of them fostered by Mrs. Thatcher in her speeches and her autobiography. That the single market was achieved by primarily political struggle and that it was detached from what followed at Maastricht, that is, monetary and political union. But actually, its origins have to be assessed in two dimensions. Externally, in responding to the crisis for leading European industries, I think of chemicals, electronics, steel, cars, and lorries, and the various financial sectors, a crisis created by the threat of competition from America and Japan imports, and particularly for London and other financial capitals, by American banks and financial institutions. And internally, in the various pressures to create a real single market free not only of physical frontier barriers to trade, but the whole range of indirect, usually state-sponsored ones, such as defense of national champions. Long before the British government became involved in what became the political conjunction achieved between 1980 and 84, the driving factors therefore included the industrial players, both as individuals and peak organizations, the central banks, and a few far-sighted banks such as Deutsche Bank, and the various member state equivalents of the CBI. To this should be added the effect of Mitterrand's turn away, with Jacques Delors' help, from what started off in 1981 as socialism in one country, and the arrival of Helmut Kohl as German Chancellor. Add in the European Commission's own regeneration, its directorate concerned with industry, DG3, continual planning, the Cecchini report, some of you may well be familiar with that and remember it, and the European Round Table, which included the giant threatened firms. And there you have a matrix, many interests, many perspectives beginning to come together. In all this, the whole was corralled by Delors, with Arthur Cofield giving precise focus and excluding from the single market project the most contentious issues such as taxation, so that areas of consensus could be generated and then arguments and compromises, finally the political push. Because there was a moment at the Athens summit when it was almost destroyed by Greek incompetence and repaired by the French at Fontainebleau in June 1984. It would take me much too long to run through the idiosyncratic positions of all the 12 member states. Enough to say that they all differed widely in national self-interest, but in the end they all agreed sufficiently to coincide and to pass 285 legislative items on Cofield's list. This is a remarkable realignment of perceptions about self-interest in less than half a decade. But I will just mention four. West Germany, still West Germany, sought economic growth in the context of a carefully balanced position east-west between America and Russia and its relationships with France. And within that, the balance between central government and lender government, all embodied in the hope of progress towards political union. France was already moving far beyond the idea of a community in French clothes, towards using it to modernize French industry and finance, but on French terms, plus turning the ERM into monetary union, and bearing in mind social Europe and political union to contain the German challenge. The Netherlands, still fulfilling the fundamental aims of 1957, anti-protectionism, and the rights of small as well as giant firms. Spain, the newcomer, trying to face the harsh challenge of matching European levels in every industry to restructure the whole industrial base to attract foreign direct investment and to counter what was already a high rate of inflation. So many positions, to which I would add an important one, the entry of the whole financial sectors, of banks, insurance companies, stock exchange, as the single market's wider scope became clear. Even so, the project could have foundered if it weren't for the German presidency's firm leadership in June 1988 at the Hanover summit. The 285 items became law on 1st of January 1993, by which time Mrs. Thatcher had already gone, having changed her mind about much of it. Social Europe, which had always been Delors' main concern, was back on the agenda, together with monetary union, which, whatever Mrs. Thatcher imagined, she did know, but later denied that she knew. So that's the single market. We come to Maastricht. If one takes a general view, political and monetary union were indeed inevitable consequences of the single market. They were, from many member state and Brussels perspectives, an integral part of the Treaty of Rome, delayed only because there had been a lack of consensus and because of the sheer difficulty of handling it all together, both factors which contributed to the problems that I see as overlap perceptions. At Maastricht, you have two concurrent meetings. It's a sort of updated Congress of Vienna. It couldn't avoid overlap because the proceedings were occurring just as the 285 legislative parts of the single market were still being processed into law by member states. So at one end, you have what was essentially the congruence of an elite bargaining forum engaged on entirely separate issues, largely out of the public view, which couldn't easily be made compatible with the wider public debate about the significance of what had already been achieved in the single market legislation. Now, this statement doesn't mean that monetary union wasn't a necessary corollary to the single market. At the time, it certainly appeared so. And what one can put together as social Europe became of greater concern to many of the players as the single market's implications actually became clear in the 1990s. And, not forgetting, political union was central to German requirements, the more so once Germany was reunited. Other perceptions also intruded, that Northern European members were not only more efficient at implementing the single market than the Club Med in the south, but more effective at policing it. And the Mezzogiorno in southern Italy becomes a byword for waste and corruption. I have to say that if one looks at the last 10 years, much of this has been reformed. EU governance certainly improved as a result of Maastricht, and the whole problem of waste in and misspending of its funding problems had at least partly been addressed by the 2000s. Most of all, the Franco-German motor, as it's often described, involved a deep political bargain that the French would accept Germany's need for moves towards political union and would concede that, providing that monetary union took place via the ERM's mutation into a single currency, the euro, enabling France to constrain Germany's ability to dominate the whole from a Deutschmark baseline. Even to put it like that, suggests an aggregated aim of a guided market with federal implications. And I'm not sure that it's yet possible to tell the whole complex story as it really was, given the incompatible inputs of different commission officials and different member states, with aims as widely separate as Spain's leverage on behalf of Spanish interests and the opt-out from monetary union that John Major won precisely because he was not Mrs. Thatcher. What can be said is that the 12 member states were far less coherent than they had been over the single market, aligned on a variety of axes, north-south, large-small, poor-richer. The same applied to the raft of interior ministry issues such as crime and immigration. And all this complexity was not and probably could not be aired in public until the Maastricht treaties on political and monetary union were complete. Yet, despite the 1992-93 crisis which followed EMU, it was thought through. It did resolve many of the arcane problems, particularly of monetary union. It didn't omit the implications, and today, I think we would all agree, the euro appears quite secure. Even on crime, terrorism, and immigration, progress took place, which should perhaps be compared with American and Russian experience with similar problems vis-à-vis Mexico and Central Asia. So I'm not saying Maastricht was mishandled. What did emerge also were a number of conceptual debates about the word federal and what might be a substitute phrase to appease Britain's fears while retaining ever closer union. What was the precise legal formula to define national law within European jurisdiction? And how should the European project be described? Either as a tree which supports its branches or as a temple supported by three pillars? Just consider the differences of perception embodied by those two concepts. It's hard to overestimate the significance of the problems addressed at Maastricht, and in that sense only, its proceedings should be distinguished from the relative simplicity of the single market. And one can suggest that Delors may have aimed too high, too early, seeing a blue time to bring the whole project together. Afterwards, facing deep unpopularity, the Commission and Delors himself took years to recover what they regarded as their proper role. And even so, much of what was achieved at Maastricht was simplified or misinterpreted, setting up the public picture on which Denmark voted no on the first round and only just yes on the second after huge opt-outs had been granted. So already then, there existed a deep conflict of perceptions about the basic historiography of the process and how it should be interpreted, much of which is still alive. This rift between the various public's perceptions and what to insiders really goes on in the EU has not gone away. And its source was a genuine dilemma that to achieve a consensus of 12, let alone 27 members, is so hard that to do it in public is virtually impossible, unless everybody's agreed in advance. Doing it in private, on the other hand, gives rise to suspicion of elite conspiracy, which makes a referendum on the result unpredictable at best. Witness the French and Netherlands' rejection of the first effort at a European constitution. No wonder there was no referendum on the Maastricht Treaty outcomes. Spain and Portugal consciously resisted one. Germany claimed not to need one. France was finally forced to and won it by a tiny margin of only 51.05%. Britain avoided it on the basis of Major's opt-outs, which themselves were contingent on the Danes' final acceptance. Maastricht became, in fact, the implicit model and catalyst for the next decade, and Britain's current avoidance of a referendum merely replicates Major's answer in 1992. Measuring Maastricht then becomes not simply a matter of gauging success. Indeed, how could one measure that? By the competition between stock exchanges in Paris, Frankfurt, and London? By the strength of the euro in relation to the dollar, the yen? Well, one would have to have intimate knowledge of how China's central bank manipulates its overseas investments to judge that. Now, I suggest that since Maastricht, even where group perceptions converge, as they do, for example, when central bankers meet together, sharing an ethos as well as a common language, there's no longer a canonical truth for them to appeal to, only evidence of theological diversity. Whatever disagreements exist within Britain's Conservative Party or France's socialist one, between Polish parties or Spanish regions, there is no longer, I believe, an effective scripture to appeal to, but rather a negotiable flux only loosely based on the Treaty of Rome. Which may allow me to make two quick points about the current treaty or constitution bis. The first one was perhaps an elegant epiphany for the 1990s. This one, a catalogue of amendments rather than replacing previous treaties, seems to me A, relatively trivial on the constitutional side, B, valuable, possibly essential as an administrative easement. With a lot of loose talk, including the human rights section, which may not be precise enough for the European Court of Justice to accept a case at all. Even the unexploded bombs, like Nicolas Sarkozy's, I have to say, public relations success in removing the words free and undistorted competition, is undermined by being restored to the footnotes. And in any case, this whole question may turn out not to be justiciable when set against 50 years of serviceable competition legislation. So, it may be that the whole thing amounts to what Geoffrey Howe called in 1982 the Stuttgart Declaration. It was like hanging baubles on a moving Christmas tree. After all, it gives greater stability to the presidency and to foreign policy. It makes the commission more efficient. And even if Portugal's contribution, for example, has not, if Poland's contribution has not been propitious, and there may be much more to calm my fear from former Eastern European countries such as Romania and Bulgaria, there's not a great deal of evidence that euro paralysis has set in. As for the issue of a referendum in Britain, which, if any of you read The Independent, Giscard d'Estaing had a large piece in it, he makes it quite clear that the treaty was designed to avoid a referendum. I note only that in 1974-75, Mrs. Thatcher favoured parliamentary debate on the supremacy of Parliament. It was Harold Wilson hoping to heal divisions in the Labour Party and truly to involve the British public who committed us to a referendum. And I would ask, seriously, is the public now wiser enough, educated enough to repeat 1975, or is it less so? And that's in fact my last question, the extent of misperception and downright distortion cleverly or stridently put by the anti-Europeans in Britain. I am wearing my heart on my sleeve. To take one specific case only, the Daily Telegraph recently charged that a provision in the treaty to ensure member state energy cooperation in the event of a shortfall crisis is put as if it were an assault on Britain's security of supply. Yet if that had existed 2 years ago in grave shortages in the winter. It would materially have helped us when our fellow member states refused to fill the cross-channel gas pipelines for fear of running down their own stocks. For all I know, this treaty clause was actually a British input into the document. Yet, having said that, the sceptics have many good points, especially if they're detached from the hotbed of perceptions which surround them. One must say that important matters have always been slipped in, as they were in the Treaty of Rome, in coded language to be revisited later. That's the way the body works. Opt-outs can be circumscribed, as British hours of work opt-outs were, by bringing in a directive based on health and safety, not employment law. On the other hand, social Europe is often a much-needed restraint on an untrammeled free market. There is also some evidence to support a perception that further majority voting will facilitate a federal drift, a point I have already made, even if there has never really been such a thing as a free market bloc within the EU to be undermined by it. Perhaps the ante's most important perception concerns the dangers of legalism and lawyers' hegemony, in which area statements might become later precisely construed by the court. Yet the ECJ, the European Court of Justice, it's not an American-type Supreme Court. Its members are not appointed by a single president of any political persuasion. It has its own culture, almost a group language like central bankers. It has very highly qualified judges and advocates general. And despite the Roman European law legacy, under British influence over the last 20 years, it now gives much greater weight to existing legal precedents. How then should I conclude? Historians have to keep two lines of argument in balance. First, the perceptions differ widely among institutions and member states and change over time, in accordance with much wider global change. Secondly, spatial change, certainly over the last 50 years, occurs not only with the extension of member states, but with the addition of whole sectors of the economy, such as banking and finance, and with new issues, immigration, terrorism, and the legitimate extent of religious beliefs' impact on civil society. Second, there is a problem in describing the core, the EU itself. I like to think of a blindfolded committee trying to measure the elephant in the room in order to answer the question, what is it for? Is it to regulate, to discipline, to enable, to facilitate, to encourage, or to ameliorate, even remedy disadvantages? And what should its areas of concern be beyond the economic? Should it cover all facets of life, like a state, or only some? Short point, whatever is said in Brussels, the EU remains, as it always was, as much reactive as an originator, reactive to other forces in the global economy. And if I had more time, I would cite the case of our dependence on Russian gas and possible choices for alternatives, such as Central Asia, and whether it is better to look at a country like Uzbekistan and ask, is it democratic or has it got a lot of gas? Fourthly, whatever its problems, the mutation from EEC to EU has in fact moved surprisingly quickly, often nearly as fast as its leading members, sometimes even faster, and not usually wrongly, in my opinion. Then again, the overlap of perceptions and the resulting misperceptions becomes as complex as the reality. And so a final question for you, perhaps not for me, is, has it perhaps reached the limits of membership and scope as a political economic artifact? Can it indeed be held together? Nationalism has not withered away, and the interplay remains as factious and factitious as ever. Are we on the edge of Dover Beach, listening to a long withdrawing roar? Once more, Turkey is crucial. So, start from where we are, not from the Treaty of Rome, written in another century. We have to accept that the EU is always a work in process argument between its formal legacy and real momentum to whatever interest, to whatever end seems appropriate at the time. And I hope, my last word, I hope that contemporary historians can help to decide what it is that we, where it is that we actually are, since our own governments since 1975 have shown so little aptitude for public definition of their aims or relatively impartial public education to guide us on the way.
Don't go too far away. Keith, thank you. On behalf of the University of Sussex, can I really thank you for an excellent lecture this evening, a fascinating analysis of the EU, and actually, Keith, you have the privilege, I think, of having very close access. Most of us see it through the lens of the press and the media, and undoubtedly introduces a distortion and yet another perspective. So your analysis, which was so clear and concise, I think really did help us see how contemporary history can illuminate the present.